Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 72, The Fermented Man. Hey everybody, thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I am Roger, your host, and this is the podcast that helps aspiring home cooks grow their skills and confidence in the kitchen. Well, today I've got a really cool episode lined up for you on a topic I haven't really touched on yet in the show. We're going to be talking about fermentation. And in fact, it's such a special episode. I was able to sit down with a gentleman named Derek Dellinger, and he is an author and a brewer and a fermenter, among many other things. And he is releasing a book on the 19th in just a couple of days, called The Fermented Man, A Year on the Front Lines of a Food Revolution. Well, I was able to get a copy of the book and read it before I sat down and talked with Derek. And I have to say, I really, really loved the book and I recommend it wholeheartedly. If you like books about food, if you like books about the history or the science of cooking or food, and you like just people doing interesting things and trying to push the boundaries of what they can do, you know, a la eating only fermented foods for a year, I think you'll really enjoy this book. It's well written, deeply researched, and is quite humorous in parts. It was a really a good read, so I highly recommend it. And just keep in mind, if you head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/72, you can get to the show notes for this episode, and I'll have a link to the Amazon page for The Fermented Man, along with links to some of Derek's online blogs and things like that. Well, I won't take a lot of time building this up. I want to get right into the conversation with Derek, where we talk about his book, his year eating fermented foods, but we also talk a lot about fermentation and fermented foods. So I learned a ton, both by reading Derek's book and by having this conversation with him, and I think you will too. Derek Dellinger is a writer, brewer, and fermentation enthusiast based in the Hudson Valley. He's the brewmaster at Kent Falls Brewing Company, the first farmhouse brewery in the state of Connecticut, and undoubtedly the only brewery in the area spontaneously fermenting beers outside of a barn in an old milk chiller. Derek also writes about home brewing, fermentation, food, and beer for a number of publications, including his blog, which you can find at www.bearflavored.com. That's bear-flavored.com. All right, without further ado, here is my conversation with Derek Dellinger, The Fermented Man. Well, I'm here with Derek Dellinger, who is the author of The Fermented Man, a new book I just had the pleasure of reading. And the subtitle is A Year on the Front Lines of a Food Revolution. So, Derek, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is really cool. I was really excited to get a hold of this book and read it because I don't know a lot. I mean, I know a little bit about fermentation, and I can probably, on one hand, you know, name off fermented foods that come to mind. But after reading your book, I realized, oh, wait, there's a lot more fermented food out there that you just kind of take for granted that you don't really realize is a product of a process of fermentation. And I think a lot of my listeners are probably in that same boat where they kind of get it and they can name off some. I'm sure some are much more into it, and maybe some even do fermenting on their own. But I wanted to go through some of that. But before we get there, maybe if you could just give a little bit of background about yourself and how in the world you came to decide to write a book, or not even write the book, but how did you decide to live on only fermented foods for a year?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a result of you know, a unique combination of being a writer and for a couple years a home brewer, and just I tend to gravitate, I guess, towards, you know, big, weird, stupid ideas. And it was this, you know, strange pathway that I had been brewing beer for a few years in my apartment in Brooklyn and then upstate in the Hudson Valley, and got into, you know, the weirder beer styles and mixed culture fermentation, and you're using all these different bacteria and yeast strains. And the brewing world right now is really kind of getting obsessed and interested in these unique yeast strains that really weren't known or understood before 10, 15 years ago. And there's these styles of beers now being brewed with 100% wild yeast that just wasn't possible decades ago because it hadn't been cultured and wasn't available in yeast labs, and brewing with it in the wild, you know, you're always going to end up with a mixed culture and never an isolated yeast strain of that kind. So I was getting into all these kind of weird esoteric things that are just kind of becoming mainstream within the beer industry itself. And I became fascinated with how some of these bacteria and yeast are popping up in other foods. And I would start to see things like lactobacillus advertised on, you know, artisanal sauerkraut or yogurt and, you know, small scale, you know, local artisanal foods. And I started to have this kind of train of thought where I realized, oh, wow, like a lot of these microbes are not isolated to any one thing. And the more you do some research into it, the more you realize they're kind of universal. And some of them are found in pretty much every category of food that we eat. The lactobacillus bacteria ends up making, you know, a lot of the sour beers that we drink. It's found in yogurt and kimchi and sauerkraut and cured meats. And basically, again, every category of food from dairy to meat to beverages. And it's this kind of universal web of fermentation that up until recently, no one was really talking about, no one was really aware of. So that kind of the universal nature of it really fascinated me. Just the fact that it's this extensive food production method that just no one was talking about, you know, even up to now, it's just kind of under the radar. And the idea that you could live off of only fermented food popped in my head because it is so extensive, because it covers so much ground. I don't know why that particular idea popped into my head. I think that's just how my brain works, like taking things to extremes, because I like experimenting and pushing boundaries, and it's what I was trying to do with my homebrewing. And, you know, I looked out at all the different fermented foods I was kind of reading about, and that idea just popped into my head. And through various accidents and just happening to sort of almost jokingly, you know, push that idea in front of certain people, at some point I ended up with a book deal as a result. And my editor kind of came back to me and said, you know, I think this idea that you're talking about is really interesting, and I think it would actually make a good book. And kind of encouraged me to research it further and see if it was something that I thought I could actually do, that I would be interested in doing. And I decided I was. I thought it would be a really interesting experiment and a really fun way to kind of, you know, write a book that would educate people about fermentation and show them that it's out there in ways that they've never realized before.
Yeah, one thing, let's get one thing out of the way, just a quick bit of housekeeping, just because I want to make sure as we talk a little bit more here that everyone's on the same page. And sure. can you just give like a definition, like what is fermentation or the act of fermenting something and what isn't? And I think, so when I said I could name off fermented foods, I mean, obvious ones come to mind, right? Booze, beer, wine, alcoholic beverages, right? That's an obvious one. Sauerkraut, right. I think of. I even think of pickles, but in many cases, the pickles that we're eating aren't actually fermented. They're pickled, which is different, right? So what is fermentation and how is it different from like canning or preserving foods in other ways?
Yeah. And that's a great foundational question that, like you said, very, very few people, even people who are into fermentation, don't really fully understand the boundaries of. I mean, I've talked to many people who, you know, it would try, you know, during my year of fermentation, they would get me to try something and I'd keep asking questions about it. And they were sure they knew all about fermentation, and I would ask a few questions and have to point out like, oh, this isn't actually fermented. You know, you just pickled this with vinegar in a certain way. Like you said, most pickles they're kind of pasteurized in hot vinegar to preserve them. So they're preserved through acidity and heat, which kills the microbes rather than allowing microbes to work at the food. So the basic definition of fermentation, kind of as I see it, the most general way you can look at it is just food that's been in some way acted upon by microbial forces. It's really hard to define. Like even if you go on Wikipedia, something like Wikipedia, you'll see a couple definitions, and they try to be more technical and more scientific than the kind of broader definition that I just gave. And you can kind of find counterexamples that disprove that definition or whatever, that you would still consider fermented but don't quite fall under that. So I think the broadest way to look at it is really anything in which you're allowing living microbes to kind of work at the food and preserve it in some way. And that's a pretty broad definition, and there's definitely a lot of gray area with fermentation. You can get into some interesting things and debate, okay, what actually counts as fermented? You know, when does raw milk, which is rich with living microbes, start to become fermented? When it starts to clabber, when it separates, you know, there's there's definitely a gray area where you can start to question when the microbes are doing what. But, you know, the basic starting definition is, I think, anything where preservation is usually a part of it and where microbes are responsible.
Okay, cool. That's great. And in fact, I think in the book, you laid it out pretty simply like that. You said that is fermentation, and then canning or preserving is basically the exact opposite, where you're trying to remove right. all of the microbes.
Exactly.
And you're a quote unquote dead zone. So let's jump back a little bit. And I might jump back and forth between the book and fermentation, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So one of the things that surprised me when I read the subtitle of the book before I even started the book, and I'm thinking, or I read the back jacket or whatever, and it's like, wow, you're going to live on fermented foods for a year. What are you going to, you're going to drink a lot of beer. You're going to, eat a lot of sauerkraut. You're going to eat a lot of pickles. I don't know what else, you know, whatever else popped in my mind. And then really early on in the book, you kind of got into, well, cheese, you know, is a great example. And, you know, I can always fall back on cheese because practically, well, I think every cheese by definition is a product of fermentation.
Almost, yeah. Okay. There's some like mozzarellas can be created through like acidic enzymatic reaction with vinegar.
Okay. So can you talk, and you mentioned it a few minutes ago, but just talk a little bit about some of the common foods that we're probably eating every day that we are probably just not, don't even realize that they're a product of fermentation.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting also what words we use to describe certain foods. As soon as my mom found out about this book project that I was doing, she got really, into reading about fermentation and would always like send me a text or call me when she discovered what she thought was an interesting little fermentation factoid, and would try and sometimes like, or not try, but I remember one time she called me up and she's like, well, you said you could eat yogurt. And I was like, yeah, I can generally eat yogurt. It's fermented. Like, well, this yogurt that I got says it's cultured. So that, how does that work? I'm like, well, it's just, they're using a different word for the same thing, but it sounds more appealing. You know, cultured kind of has this better ring to it, I guess, in the marketers' minds than fermented. But we use different words like that to still imply the same kind of microbial action that's being cultured by microbes. And, you know, even something as simple as bread, people often don't think of it as fermented, but it rises through the action of yeast. That's why it becomes bread and not just a lump of flour and water and salt. So even something as kind of gross as Wonder Bread is still technically fermented, only for a couple hours, 3 or 4 hours, but the yeast causes the dough to rise. So there's still fermentation happening. You know, obviously I was trying to eat somewhat better breads than that during my year of fermentation. But, you can get into some really amazing, long-term sourdough fermentations, but it branches out so much, and covers, bread and cheese, and big one is meat that people don't think of, and salami and prosciutto and pepperoni even are all fermented products. Again, with a lot of these same microbes that, people don't realize this, lactobacillus is in pepperoni and yogurt as well.
Yeah, that was interesting to me when I read pepperoni. And then once you stop to think about it, though, it's like, yeah, I guess that makes sense when you look at how it's produced.
Right.
But you just don't think about, eating a pepperoni pizza is practically right. a product, almost all fermented foods, except like what the sauce, unless you have a fermented
Pretty
sauce
much.
Or something, right? You're right. eating a fermented meal.
Yeah, it's some pizza that's sat around for a while before you got the slice, maybe the sauce counts too by that point. They'll hide the terminology again in the cured meat's a good example, because if you look at a lot of like pepperoni or salami in the stores, it won't say bacteria's in it, but it'll say lactic acid starter cultures, which just means that they added some kind of lactic acid producing bacteria to make that product, but they're using different terminology.
Yeah. So one of the things I really liked about the book, and by the way, the book, I really enjoyed it. It was really well written, very humorous, but very well researched and kind of a scientific approach, which I really appreciated. One of the things that I thought was so interesting about it was you came to a point to where you started talking about cooking food versus like a raw diet. And when I got to that point, I thought, oh man, this is what that Richard Wrangham, I think his name is, wrote, right? Catching Fire.
Yep.
And it was so cool because there was like 4 or 5 points in the book where I'm thanking something And literally a page or two later, you get to it. And I'm like, oh, this is awesome, because it was just like ticking off all my boxes. But you made a very interesting point about how cooking is a process that makes food easier to digest the nutrients in for human beings, for example. But fermentation really is the same end product. It's just a different method to get there. And I think you even made the argument in the book that maybe fermentation came before cooking because it's more of a natural, it'll just happen on its own. You really don't have to do anything too special in the case of really simple ferments to make it happen, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, they're both very ancient and very natural processes. I mean, yeah, fire will happen naturally in cook, I'm sure, sometimes some hapless animal,
sure,
whether someone's around to eat it or not. And fermentation kind of the same way. I mean, you have some pool of nutrients collecting somewhere, and something microbial or otherwise is going to utilize that resource and consume it. And that's probably how people discovered this stuff early on. They might not have been stuffing cabbage into mason jars to make sauerkraut, but, you know, early on they probably discovered how to make mead by, you know, some honey spilled out in the crack of a tree or in the ground, and you're in a vessel of some kind. And honey, if diluted with water, even if it's, you know, rainwater, will start to ferment on its own. And fruit, when it's overripe, even starts to, you know, ferment, and animals themselves will take advantage of that. So it's not hard to imagine how we kind of first discovered these forces. And exactly like you said, they make food easier for us to digest, and they make the nutrients more readily available. And in the case of fermentation, even add nutrients that weren't, you know, within the food in the first place. So a lot of fermentation will add, you know, B vitamins, unlock vitamins that are there. You know, you're getting the microbes, the probiotic effects, the prebiotic effects from their digestion, and, you know, making the food easier for us to break down because the microbes have already been breaking it down in the first place.
Yeah. Can we, I actually was going to ask this a little bit later, but I think this is a good segue. You know, when I first started the book, I thought, again, oh, I wonder if this is, once I get past kind of the introductory chapter, is this going to be basically like a diary of his year? And thankfully it wasn't. I mean, you weave that in there, but you go into so much more detail on specific type of ferments. You have a whole chapter, I think, on brewing beer, for example. But you also go into a lot of detail about the history or maybe the conventional wisdom on a lot of health-related issues and diet-related issues. I really appreciate the fact that you're not, on the one hand, promoting some sort of a miracle cure-all diet by eating just fermented foods. That wasn't your goal. And I'm also glad you're skeptical, because I am as well, of any sort of silver bullet, exclusionary diet type of a thing. But I think it's undeniable, it seems, that fermenting does grant us health benefits. So aside from just making food more easy to digest or making nutrients more available to us, there's this whole micro fauna type of environment in our guts and things like that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Right. Yeah. So the probiotics angle of fermented food is certainly what's getting a lot of attention lately. It's, you know, it's a huge avenue of research that's really exciting right now. And it's honestly, it's hard to make any, you know, kind of scientific claims about it that you can really back up with the research available at the moment, which, you know, makes it really important to be looking at right now. And you know, as you mentioned, like I tend to be a skeptical person, and I really didn't want to make any grand claims in my book. And certainly one person following a unmonitored experiment for a year, like I was certainly in no position to be making any scientific claims based on my own experience. So I definitely wanted to be very clear with that in the book, that it was a, you know, educational, anecdotal, fun experiment, but not a scientific experiment. But yeah, the probiotic angle is really interesting. I mean, you have these half a dozen or so different microbes available in, you know, different fermented foods here and there. You have thousands and possibly millions of different microbes existing, you know, on our person, inside our person, in our gut, that form this incredibly complex, very difficult to unravel ecosystem that has, huge effects on our person, on how we digest food, certainly, but a lot more than that. It seems like the research seems to indicate that, you know, this can affect anything from our mood to our weight to, you know, really what type of person we are. It's this synergistic relationship with these microbes that people have feared for decades, you know, tried to rub hand sanitizer all, you know, everywhere and kill them. And turns out that our relationship with these microbes that coexist within us, you know, is incredibly vital to our well-being as a person. So it's not really clear yet, you know, if you say ingest microbe A and the population of microbe A goes up within our gut, what, you know, is that a direct relationship with, say, the fermented foods we're eating? Or is it more complicated where maybe the fermented foods are providing nutrient A and microbe C feeds on that nutrient? So that population goes up, but perhaps the population of microbe F goes down because it's being outcompeted. It's very complicated. It's very interesting to see the research that's coming out on this. It's really hard to say any specific, you know, correlation between what you eat yet and what's going to result. So, you know, with that caveat, it's definitely an important avenue of research. And I think you can assume that, you know, generally reinforcing your microbiome, you know, in your gut and in your being with reinforcements from the foods you're eating is probably going to, you know, be a good idea. And certainly trying to avoid, you know, blasting ourselves with antibiotics in how we treat ourselves for medical purposes and in the foods we eat. You know, we have a meat industry that relies far too heavily on antibiotics, and consuming that all the time without reinforcing and, you know, adding reinforcements to the microbes we're eating is probably not a good idea. So that's definitely something that we'll be seeing more research on in the next few years. And, you know, it's one of those things where you can see common sense that fermented foods are good for you in a number of ways, and probably in the specific way, including them in your diet, even if you can't say, oh, okay, this is exactly what's happening, it's certainly a good idea to do so, you know, to reintroduce something that we've been eating for thousands of years, to reinforce a relationship with microbes that we've had since we existed as a species. You know, you want to keep that relationship going. And for decades, we interrupted it and tried to, you know, kind of eliminate these microbes from our lives. So I think reintroducing them and understanding them better is incredibly important right now.
And I think it's interesting to note that when we talk about foods that are a product of fermentation, we've danced around it, I think, but there's live culture foods and there's foods like bread, I assume, is not a live culture food, right? It's a product of fermentation, but you're not getting, well, you probably are somehow getting bacteria when you eat it. But I mean, you're not getting like lactobacillus as you are when you eat yogurt, for example.
Yeah, that's a great point. So that's, again, why this gets really complicated. So you have the probiotic effects, which are, you're literally just swallowing bacteria and kind of assuming that those bacteria will take up residence in your gut. It's not even clear exactly how much that happens, because maybe some of those bacteria don't survive your stomach acids. Maybe, you know, maybe it's too harsh an environment for them to just that literally be introduced in your body because you swallowed them in some food. So it's not even clear, you know, on that end, how directly we can take up these microbes. And a lot of the fermented foods, like you said, like bread, are not, you know, are not live culture. So you might be managing your microbiome in different ways, with the prebiotic effects, by what the microbes in the fermented food digest in the first place, what they leave behind for you, what nutrients they add. And in that sense, you're feeding the microbes that are already in your gut and perhaps steering your microbiome that way by encouraging different populations to thrive. It may be hindering ones that are more harmful. So you might not directly be swallowing the microbes themselves. You know, it might not be like take a pill full of microbes and all of a sudden those microbes are in your stomach and they're living there happily forever after. It might be less direct than that, but the result can still be the same if you're feeding the microbes that should be there in your gut in the first place.
So let's talk for a minute then about your actual year and your diet. Because again, in the book, it was kind of comical at the beginning. You thought, well, this is probably going to be more difficult than I thought it was when you started out, I think. And you document your trials and tribulations of trying different interesting variations or methods to ferment your foods. But you always kind of said, well, I can always eat a grilled cheese sandwich. Although you know, will that kill me off in the year that I'm doing it? But talk a little bit about just your year of eating. And then if you want, you had a couple of points in there where you talked about some of the more odd or weird or gross. Some people listening might think eating a live cultured pickle is gross. Some will eat practically anything. So talk a little bit about your diet and maybe some of the weird things you ate on this year journey.
Yeah, I think, people have a tendency when they're switching to any new diet to kind of try to recreate the things they ate before. So, you know, I spent a few years as a vegetarian, and, you know, a lot of vegetarians are, you know, kind of notorious for just like, I'm going to buy the vegetarian corn dogs at the grocery store. That you have that tendency to just, I still want a hamburger, so I'm just going to figure out how to recreate a hamburger now without using the thing that I can't eat. So I definitely started out kind of along that path of like, okay, how can I still eat the same things that I was eating, but eat them in a fermented form? And with a lot of things, it's not very hard. And that was kind of my point, that fermented foods encompass every type of food. So a lot of things can pretty easily be recreated. Some of them are definitely weirder when you try to recreate them. So, you know, one of the easier ones was, and you kind of had mentioned it a few minutes ago, is pizza was pretty easy to recreate as a fermented variation. And I tried to, I think in the book, create this image in readers' heads of okay, what would fermented pizza be like, and having people picture slices of pizza just floating in mason jars, fermenting like pickles. But, you know, the bread, the crust, already a product of fermentation. The cheese very easily can be a product of fermentation. Throw some pepperoni on there, and then the only thing missing is the sauce. So tomato sauce or tomatoes whole, very easy to ferment. All vegetables are extremely easy to ferment, among the easiest. So I started out doing kind of a fermented marinara sauce, and threw different herbs and spices in it, and it was a little weird. You know, you definitely have some funk to the pizza that isn't there in most instances, and you could always kind of tell there's something a little different about it. But I kept adapting my recipe, and I would start fermenting just whole, you know, whole tomatoes and slice them on the pizza and different things. And you can create some pretty interesting flavors that way that I'd love to see, you know, experimented with by more restaurants and just chefs in the future, as fermentation becomes more normalized. And, you know, I would keep trying to adapt things that I used to eat before. I tried to do fermented French fries, and I would do sweet potato fries, and they'd get this crazy looking pellicle on them, which is kind of a colony of yeast and bacteria, like you'll find on vinegar or kombucha, but more bubbly and looks kind of like the surface of an alien planet. I would mention
to listeners that if you don't want to get turned off of fermenting before you start, don't Google pellicle pictures. It's terrifying. Actually,
it can be terrifying, especially, yeah, once you get in the beer community and you see how fascinated these people are with it, you know, hopefully it becomes a little more normal. I've noticed too that a lot of even fermentation geeks have a hard time telling if it's mold or a pellicle or just floating yeast rafts or whatever. So it can be intimidating, and you just have to realize that, you know, fermented products won't harm you if they're done right. You know, if you see black mold or something, you probably should play it safe and toss it out. But if it's kind of a bubbly white film on top, it might not look super appetizing, but you can skim it off. And that's what I can do with these French fries, and then bake them the regular way. And again, you get kind of interesting results, definitely unique, different flavors. You might either love them or hate them, but, you know, I managed to recreate almost all my favorite foods that way. But you definitely have those weird results, or those, you know, those fries that are just a little too funky. Or I tried to do like some bean and rice ferments that I couldn't quite stomach because they just got a little too weird. Same with, you know, certain things that you just expect a certain texture of it. I'm a pretty open eater, but one of my Achilles heel in eating is I kind of have a texture thing. And if something just has a really unappealing texture, or whatever to me is a weird texture, I might not be able to do it. And there are a few things where I just kind of had too much of a like broken down mushy thing where I was like, oh man, this is not how this food is supposed to be. And yeah, that's going to be person to person. And I'd learned when some of my experiments had maybe gone on a bit too long. And, you know, fermentation is a spectrum. So, you know, something can be fermented for only a couple hours or a day or weeks. And I started to learn what things maybe don't need to sit for a week before I eat them, because they just get a bit too mushy and strange perhaps. And yeah, and then, you know, you get into the weirder ferments that I didn't try making at home. And there's stuff out there as odd as century eggs, which are these kind of mucousy geode looking eggs that are,
that's truly horrific, actually.
Very, very horrific. That was the one thing that I don't think I could ever eat again. I actually still have a few of them in my fridge just waiting for when I need to challenge someone to a dare. There are a few things I got to that I'm not super eager to eat again. And you can get as weird with fermentation as you want, or just kind of, you know, remember that it's as easy as everyday things like cheese and bread and yogurt, and doesn't need to get more weird than that. And that's what's cool about it. It you know, it covers the whole spectrum of flavors. You know, it creates flavor in vanilla and chocolate and coffee, things that we automatically associate with flavor and don't think of as weird at all. It, you know, vanilla is literally like a slang term for like boring and not weird, you know, all the way to rotten shark meat, which is one of the weirder foods in the world. So it definitely covers pretty much anything you can think of.
So on the more vanilla end of the spectrum, if a home cook listening to this show right now says, okay, I'm going to try fermenting something at home, what would you say would be the easiest or the couple easiest things? Like, is it literally easy enough that somebody could stop listening to this podcast, walk into the kitchen and start fermenting something, assuming they had, you know, whatever it is on hand?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It can get, you know, it can get from easy to so ridiculously easy that you might not even feel like you accomplished anything. You know, fermentation can be as easy as I mentioned with the pizza. I would take a mason jar, quart mason jar, and dump in some, you know, some tiny cherry tomatoes, the small tomatoes you can get in a little carton in the grocery store. You can literally just buy that little carton of cherry tomatoes, dump them in a mason jar, put, you know, a tablespoon of sea salt, fill up with water, screw a lid on very loosely, and that's it. You barely have to do anything. You're just creating a anaerobic environment for the bacteria to ferment the tomatoes. So the water, you're creating a brine essentially around the tomatoes, and you don't have to cut them up or anything. They'll just, you know, kind of float in that salt brine in the mason jar, and they'll ferment over the next couple of days. And you'll have these kind of like zesty, slightly salty cherry tomatoes that you can cut up for pizza or eat them as they are. And they'll be a live culture. They'll give you a probiotic benefit. They'll be partially digested by the microbes, and you really don't have to do anything at all. Like, you're literally dumping tomatoes in a jar and filling it with water, which is about as easy as cooking or anything you possibly get. And, you know, you can do slightly easier things that you do. Slice up some veggies. Again, you just put them with some salt in a jar. If you're making sauerkraut, it's kind of the same process, but you just have to pack the cabbage in the jar to create that anaerobic environment and remove oxygen from that environment and create the brine by packing it tightly rather than just pouring water in. Almost all these veggie ferments are, you know, incredibly easy to get started with.
Awesome. Well, I think that about gets us to the end of our time. But before we end, I do want to ask a couple things. Like, where can we find The Fermented Man, the book? Because it's going to be released on July 19th. And also, where can people find you if they want to learn more about you or connect on social media?
Great. The book will be out July 19th. It's on Amazon. If you search for The Fermented Man or Derek Dellinger, it'll pop up with a pre-order on Amazon right now. And be in bookstores, you know, across the country after that date. So head down to your local bookstore and request that they carry it if they haven't already gotten it. You can find me online at use the moniker Bear Flavored, B-E-A-R Flavored. Don't ask me where that came from, just kind of the internet name that I came up with years ago. So I'm on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, and my brewing blog, which is primarily homebrewing, is bear-flavor.com. And I also have thefermentedman.com, which is a Tumblr blog that I don't update as often as I should, but I'm most active on Twitter and Instagram.
Well, thank you so much, Derek. That was really awesome. And I do recommend anybody that, if you're listening to the show, you obviously like food. This is really, really a good food book. It's not just about, you know, Derek's year on fermented food that's in there. That's entertaining, but he does a lot of history. In fact, if you've read the book or if you're familiar with the book, it's kind of in the same spirit as Salt, by Mark Kurlansky, rather, or maybe like even A History of the World in Six Glasses. If you're familiar with that book, it's kind of a food by and history book. It's hard to explain, but it's very well done. So Derek, thank you so much, for being
thank
on the
you.
Show.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I appreciate it, Roger. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I hope you found that conversation with Derek Dellinger about the fermented man and fermented foods and fermenting exciting and interesting. And I hope you're interested in trying it out yourself. If you head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/72, you'll find the show notes for this episode, in which I'll include a link to Derek's book on Amazon and information on his other online blogs and social media handles. So if you want to find Derek and interact with him, he'd be more than happy to hear from you. Once again, I really recommend the book. I thought it was fantastic and a lot of fun. So thanks, Derek, for sitting down and having this conversation. Like I said in the intro, I learned a ton. All right, folks, that does it for another week of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Thanks so much once again for tuning in. If you want to send me an email, you can do so at feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. Of course, you can find me on Twitter at TKCPodcast and on Facebook at facebook.com/kitchencounterpodcast. All right, everyone, until next time, this is Roger with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Happy cooking.